Green Dream, a podcast about ethical investing for positive impact and a better future. Join me, James Baird, as I interview fund managers, advisors, and a range of leaders in sustainability about topical environmental, social, and governance issues. We look forward to joining you on your ethical investment journey. In today's ruthless world of organised crime, the best criminals aren't foolish enough to steal money out of banks. They wear tailored suits, carry briefcases, and put money into banks. In ethical investment, we often talk about ESG, i.e. the environmental, social, and governance impacts created by an investment. Environmental and social impacts are pretty easy to understand and quantify, but the G often takes a back seat. How do we assess whether a company is run ethically and ensure that it acts in the best interest of its stakeholders? Nathan Lynch's book, The Lucky Laundry, highlights how unethical practices can have a devastating impact on a company and its shareholders, and where some of Australia's biggest banks went wrong. In this discussion with Nathan, we delve deep inside this hidden world to explain how dark money has infected the lives of ordinary people and tainted Australian democracy. He opens the curtain on the hidden world of financial intelligence, where crooks and spooks play a cat and mouse game inside the world's black money markets. To borrow from the book's blurb, Australia is awash with dirty money. It flows through our economy, keeps banks running, powers big business, puts coffee on restaurant tables, seeps into clubs, pubs, sport, the art world, and anywhere that value is moved. It infiltrates real estate, costs billions in policing, and takes a terrible toll on Australian lives. What law enforcement agencies might lack in legislation and political will, they make up for with sheer resourcefulness. When they can't get at the masterminds and bigwigs, they have honed tactics that intercept the flow of illicit cash and aim to drive a wedge between crooks and their ill-gotten wealth. Nathan Lynch is a writer and international speaker who has spent two decades investigating the hidden world of dark money that fuels organised crime, corruption and violent extremism around the globe. His work peels back the layers of complex financial crime schemes. He is certified by the US Department of Justice's Elite Cybercrime Laboratory and is a program expert with the Financial Services Volunteer Corps, which provides support to developing countries to help them combat the scourges of money laundering and other serious financial crimes. Nathan has trained police, government officials, and bankers across Asia and the Middle East on the techniques the world's criminals use to conceal and clean their dirty money. I hope you enjoy this conversation with Nathan Lynch. We wish to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land we recorded on, the Wurundjeri Noongar people. We pay respects to them and their culture, and to elders past, present, and emerging. Nathan, thanks for joining us today and welcome to the Green Dream.
Oh, it's great to be here, James. Thanks for having me on the podcast.
So tell us, how did you become a financial crime expert?
Oh, well, your words, not mine, mate. So it was kind of a journey, as all of these things. I began in investigative journalism and I ended up being part of a business that became a RegTech company before we had the name RegTech. We were sort of providing really high level information and software screening tools and all the rest of it to businesses that operate in the financial services sector. And, you know, my real passion in that whole area of regulation became anti-money laundering. And over the 20 years that we were sort of doing that, I ended up, our business was bought out by Thomson Reuters. And so I joined the Thomson Reuters business and they built this huge global risk business that focused, you know, products like World Check and transaction monitoring and those things, and regulatory intelligence, helping businesses to navigate what is really a minefield of legal and regulatory and reputational risk these days. So it was kind of an accident, but a happy accident.
So you've written a story called The Lucky Laundry. It feels like crime fiction, but it's actually all true. The interesting part is it's a story about criminals who don't rob banks, but they put money into banks. There's a lot of technology and I guess the progress in IT over the years that's contributed to that, isn't there?
There is, yeah. I mean, you know, if you think back to the 1990s before this entire anti-money laundering focus existed, you had bank robbery, as, you know, people would equate financial crime with busting open a bank. And then, of course, in the 1990s, America really started as part of the drug war to focus on this new field of financial intelligence and using intel from the public sector to help law enforcement agencies identify crime by, you know, treating money as the DNA of financial crime is the way that a few law enforcement people have put it to me. So, you know, they really started focusing on using money to detect crime and also to go back and reverse engineer what had taken place. So you're sort of now in this environment where only a mug would try to rob a bank. But of course, there's vast amounts of money to be made from the art of money laundering, of getting dirty money and putting it into the financial system and moving it around and washing it and cleaning it and tumbling it and putting it out the other side. I mean, the fees for doing that service can range from 4 to 8% of the money laundered. So if you think that, you know, more than $2 trillion a year is getting washed and cleaned and pressed like a nice starched shirt, then you're talking about vast sums of money and, you know, highly motivated people who are, let's be honest, you know, they're probably in the more intelligent side of crime as opposed to, you know, moving around drugs and things like that that are really far higher risk.
So in the Australian context, it seemed to really gather a huge amount of pace with Commonwealth Bank and their development of smart ATMs. The volumes obviously went from very small deposits to huge amounts in a short amount of time. Was it a case of hubris, or is it the IT guys, or where does the buck stop?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and probably part of what I was trying to, one of the questions I was trying to explore in the book is, where does the accountability lie when things like this go wrong? We see the big financial organizations, you know, turning around and calling these failures, in the words of Ian Narev from Commonwealth Bank, a coding error, you know, and you can see they're pretty much throwing the IT team under the bus. It's a coding error, nothing to see here. You know, let's all move on. And you know, one of the interesting things about that case was that that hubris, as you call it, they had good reason to be arrogant, you know, because they had ASIC and APRA and, you know, far bigger regulators wrapped around their little finger and too timid or captured or underfunded to really take them on. And so what you saw with the money laundering case with their smart ATMs was that they were given 2 years to fix those problems. You know, behind the scenes, AUSTRAC was coming and saying to the bank, you've got issues here, you've got to fix this up. They made assurances and they didn't follow through. And all the while, they were delivering $10 billion dividends to shareholders. And the mistake that they really made was viewing AUSTRAC as just another regulator to be managed, you know, managing their regulatory risk. But in fact, AUSTRAC was part of the intelligence community and it worked really closely with criminal intelligence, the ACIC, the Australian Federal Police, ASIO, other agencies like that. So when these huge corporations sort of effectively, for want of a better term, gave the middle finger to this community of people that fight organised crime every day of their working lives, it didn't go down well. And that was really, you know, that was what led to this complete overhaul of the financial sector. You know, ultimately, it was the last straw that gave us a royal commission. You know, all of these flow-on consequences. So you can see how an organization and a board and a senior management team might want to deflect and call it a technical error. But at the end of the day, it always, James, it always comes back to governance and organizational culture in issues like that.
And governance is just, sometimes it's so hard to put your finger on what actually is governance. And these are some classic examples that are outlined in the book. In this case as well with Commonwealth Bank, as I say, the cosy relationship with the regulators, there's a distinctly West Australian flavour to that, given the Bank West story, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. And I think, you know, I don't think the Bank West story, it's sort of a subtext of the book, but it's a really important part of it that I wanted to include in there, because even the Hayne inquiry didn't get to the bottom of what actually happened with Bank West. And the closure of Bank West, you know, when HBOS came in from the UK and swashbuckling down and, you know, bought Bank West, and their goal was to turn that into the fourth largest bank in Australia. And in doing so, they would become the fourth pillar. So if they built Bankwest fast enough, they could have taken over a NAB, you know, and effectively then they would be the fourth pillar. And they could even be the first pillar, you know, by merging if they built their business big enough. So you had this sort of attack by stealth on the Australian Four Pillars policy. And they came in and they were building their business so fast with so little regard for prudential regulation. And, you know, prudential regulation for your listeners is the school of regulation that prevents bank runs and bank collapses and events like the global financial crisis. So when they came in and they started just building their business in Western Australia and up the east coast of New South Wales and entire east coast of Australia, really, they were building business and they had no idea of the composition of their loan book. You know, that was one of the incredible things that I found researching this book, was that when HBOS blew up, it was the second worst performing, when Bankwest blew up, it was the second worst performing bank in the HBOS portfolio outside of Ireland. So they had, you know, they had about a quarter of their loans were non-performing loans. You know, that for every $4 of business they wrote, they were losing a dollar in bad loans. So, you know, it was an absolute catastrophe. And the consequences, the human consequences of that were enormous. You know, all those honest, hardworking businesses that had to have their loans foreclosed when the cleanup operation happened. And also, you know, for CBA to take over Bankwest required an act of parliament to be repealed in WA that had sat in place for over 100 years to ensure that Western Australia had its own bank. Now, when Bankwest was folded into Commonwealth Bank and gave up its ADI license, in effect, it became a sub-brand of CBA. And for about 10 years after that, you pretty much saw a stagflationary environment in WA. You know, no, while the East Coast property market was blowing up, Australian housing was declining or stagnant for a decade. And that was a reflection of lending policies. So it's had all of these flow-on consequences, and Western Australia now doesn't have a major bank headquartered in the state to power the interests of Western Australian consumers. All of that financial power has moved to the East Coast. So it's a very interesting state of affairs for WA. And, you know, you can point it back to, ultimately, a failure of prudential regulation around 2007, 2008.
And there's so many small business owners that have got stories about that they'd kept up to date with all of their repayments, and then their loan just got closed out by Bankwest. And as you say, it's to understand that, you're going to understand the history of the whole HBOS story. Pretty scary.
That's right.
To even more unsavory stories, the Westpac debacle, and certainly in our business personally, we were affected by it because one of our clients had not only his bank accounts closed by Westpac, but also his super fund. Would you believe during the COVID dip, which eventually became a pretty fast V-shaped recovery, but the timing wasn't great to close his super fund because he was an expat Australian working overseas, and his family were based in the Philippines. So he was someone that was sending money to the Philippines, in a very legitimate and transparent sort of way. And Westpac said, we don't want any part of that. We're just closing all of your accounts. Goodbye. So it's a bit of a sledgehammer approach to Westpac, I guess, being caught out for not having the controls in place. You know, is that the best way to deal with things?
It's a really, you know, that's just such a complex area. And you know, we explore that in the book through the example of, you know, a gentleman who was running a remittance business, and he got caught up in that what we call de-risking, where banks turn around and just, you know, they find themselves on the wrong side of an AUSTRAC action or a reputational risk disaster, and then they go overboard in terms of caution and risk aversion and wholesale close down entire business sectors or customer types. So, you know, you might be running a lawful remittance business and all of a sudden you can't keep bank account open. It happened to a lot of cryptocurrency exchanges, for better or worse. And of course, it happened to people that were moving funds legitimately. You know, the diaspora from the Philippines that's working in Australia and sending money home to support family also got caught in some of this. So, you know, there is people might be amazed that there's no right to banking services in Australia. Although having a bank account is fundamental to living in the modern age, you don't have any legal right to a bank account, and they can be closed on you. And certainly commercial bank accounts can be closed even more easily. So you've got these really, really radical situations where a bank fails to really invest in its risk infrastructure. And let's face it, that is not an option extra in banking. Banking is all about risk management. And so they're failing in their risk management. And then when they get caught, you get this, you know, massive countervailing swing in the other direction, huge risk aversion, the loss of market share, you know, the closure of areas where they no longer have a risk tolerance. And that leads to huge shareholder value destruction. So, you know, it's a complex area, James. I don't really, you know, I don't really have any answers in that regard as to how banks navigate that, because, you know, we also saw that in the CBA case, where after they got busted and paid their $700 million, they were doing this passive-aggressive thing behind the scenes where the AFP was coming to them about a high-risk customer and alerting them to it and asking for intelligence, and they would turn around and close that account. And it was regarded in law enforcement circles as a kind of a FU in return for them being busted by AUSTRAC. So there's a lot of complexity that goes on. And, you know, you look at banks that manage their risk really well. So ANZ is a great example we can hold up and say there's an organisation that took financial crime really seriously. And they're still, you know, they're still doing those activities that other banks might have deemed too risky. But the reality is, if you've got good risk controls, you can differentiate and be more granular. So, you know, hats off to ANZ for the way that they've performed while their peers are getting absolutely smashed by regulators.
The phrase "too much cash, not enough flow" comes up a few times in the book. And I'm really interested to understand the effect on the Australian residential property market, because as we know, it's sort of a quasi-religion here, property. What is the story? Has it really pushed up our property prices?
That is an interesting issue that I had to grapple with in this book because, yeah, you know, property is one of the Australian religions. And it has, you know, it has absolutely captured Canberra. We've now, you know, in the 2008 crisis, we had an opportunity to reset and take a different path. And instead we doubled down and we just, you know, I use the analogy that we basically pulled out the punch bowl again. We got the band out and we played one more song into the dawn. And so where we are now is, We are in an incredible position as a nation where how do you unwind this mess that we've created with debt loads and the housing bubble and all the rest of it? It's really difficult. So it's kind of captured policy because no government wants to be in power when this house of cards declines. And, you know, I mean, where does that leave us? So how do you quantify it? Well, it's kind of impossible to quantify the actual dollar impact of allowing, you know, foreign kleptocrats and drug cartels and money launderers who are pulling capital illegally out of China under Chinese law, you know, all of these kinds of offences. How much of it is landing in Australia? Well, we know it's vast sums of money, you know, like $96 billion a year is a fairly reasonable estimate. Now, how much is that propping up the property market? We just don't know. I mean, in the recent Senate inquiry, AUSTRAC turned around and said we can't really quantify the impact because we don't see it. By definition, Australia has decided at a policy level that that shouldn't be visible. So we can only do an estimate. So that was why in the book I really focused on the more moral side of it. So just the pure fact that young Australians are being priced out of the property market. And we as a society cannot guarantee when they go to an auction or bid on a house, we cannot guarantee them as a society that they're not bidding against a criminal group that might be cuckoo surfing money or a drug dealer or, you know, a dodgy investment scammer who's washing their money through Australia, because we have literally decided not to look and not to reform that. So I kind of focus on the moral aspect of it. I think that's just a betrayal of anyone in Australia that doesn't yet own a home. It's morally bereft of any integrity. And really, the quantum doesn't matter as a society. I think most Australians that I speak to think that that's completely odious and unacceptable. But in terms of the exact dollar value, well, it's kind of a bit of a stab in the dark because as a nation, we've decided to just wear the blindfold.
Yeah, hopefully some people in Canberra decide to read the book. I might have to send a few copies over.
Well, I mean, Deb O'Neill is an amazing senator and she's read the book. She's a fan. She's one of the characters in the book. And, you know, she made a commitment recently at an event that I was at in Sydney where she said that this issue is a top-tier concern in Canberra and it will be dealt with in this current term of government. So that was right. You know, pretty encouraging, pretty exciting news. And we've got an amazing Attorney General in Mark Dreyfus. The portfolio that covers this area has been moved from Home Affairs to the Attorney General's Department and it's now in Dreyfus's camp. And he's the real deal. So I'm pretty confident that we'll see the reform in this term of government, which is good news.
Yeah, looking forward to it. Talking about drug dealers, the idea of Mexican cartels, which we see in Hollywood movies and sometimes on our TV and in news reports of absolute carnage going on with machine gun fire in Mexico, they get a mention in the book. Are they headed for Australia? Are they already here?
They're here. Yeah, make no mistake. They are here. I mean, it's just a huge commercial opportunity. Our success in controlling our borders, you know, being a country with hard borders all around, makes us a really lucrative place to bring drugs, of course, because it's harder to get in. So the price that can be commanded is higher. Couple that with our level of affluence and you've got people in Sydney who are more than happy to pay $350 for a gram of coke. So as multinational corporations, which is what these drug cartels are, they make an assessment that Australia's a good market to get into. So previously, a lot of those drugs have kind of gone over the border into the United States and then moved down to Australia because obviously a shipment will carry less scrutiny if it's coming from the US as opposed to Sinaloa or Colombia, for instance. So, you know, that's been one of the pathways is getting through that southern border in the US and then coming into Australia. What we're now seeing is that they're actually becoming more direct and moving it through Pacific Islands as staging posts and places like that. So, you know, the stakes of this game are just so high. And unfortunately, you know, we're making ourselves even more attractive because once you have got that product across the border into Australia and by dint of the magic of the alchemy of drug prohibition, you are generating vast sums of money. We're then allowing them to purchase some of our best property and wash those proceeds through that without scrutiny. So there's a whole bunch of factors there that are making Australia, you know, very attractive. And the law enforcement community have been crying out to Canberra for many years saying, you know, we've got to take this more seriously. And really it's just fallen on deaf ears.
Yeah, losing the war on drugs, I guess, is the global story, isn't it?
It's been that way for three decades, right? It makes you wonder whether a new approach is needed, you know, when prohibition has completely failed us for three decades.
Maybe it's a topic for the next book.
Maybe. There are some great books on that subject, which right. Listeners can hunt down. Narconomics is a really good one. Okay. Yeah, and Gangster Warlords is another really good one where you can look at, you know, the commercial and political realities of the war on drugs.
Yeah, have to look them up. Now, moving to share markets, most of us have heard of the Wolf of Wall Street and familiar with what a penny dreadful is. I am interested in the connection of the Wolf of Wall Street, I guess, to the book and to money laundering. Can you just briefly explain that?
Yeah, well, that's another little subplot that's in there that people might find interesting. You know, when you're researching something like this over 5, 10, 20 years, kind of, which is what I've done, you find all of these incredible subplots. You can't do them all justice in one book, but I kind of go into that at some level. But effectively, that story of the Wolf of Wall Street that everyone's familiar with, the boiler room, you know, and Jordan Belfort and all the rest of it, that was just what we call the blow-off stage of a massive Russian and Italian money laundering scheme involving securities. And basically what they were doing was they were trading in the pink slips, which are, like securities that can trade off market, over the counter for a period of, I think it's 45 days before IPO. And so if you have related parties trading that stock, you can absolutely ramp a stock pre-IPO, get it to an absolutely insane valuation, and then you have a situation where you can sell that between related parties on market when it floats, and you can launder money in plain sight. So you've got a worthless company, and these two parties that want to transfer money will do it through stock trades using offshore vehicles. And I'm potentially spending $50 million on worthless scrip, and we move our money in plain sight on off market. So you've got that environment, and that's what they were doing. And it was just incredibly audacious, but very skilled and complex scheme. And one of the characters in my book, Neil Jeans, was a young copper who kind of accidentally found himself leaving the UK because he picked up the UK end of that scheme, and he got brought in the investigation. And at the end of the day, what happened was, criminals are nothing if not motivated and bright and inventive. And they decided that after they'd laundered the money through these worthless stocks, why not go one extra step and sell them to John Citizen and, make some money through the financial scam as well as through the launder? And so that was where Belfort came in. He was getting given these stocks by, criminals. And, then those penny dreadfuls were being sold on market to, in a lot of cases, the most vulnerable investors. And, it was a tragedy in many cases. But behind it was this huge mafia money laundering operation involving hundreds of millions of dollars that very few people are aware of. And the movie The Wolf of Wall Street, in its glorification, really, of Belfort and his era, didn't touch on that at all.
Do you think Jordan really knew exactly where the money was coming from?
Oh, I wouldn't say that. That would be a defamatory statement. All I'll say is that, from my law enforcement contacts, those stocks had a colourful history, and it doesn't really matter whether he knew or not. He'd been convicted had settlements, all the rest of it, over his boiler room activity. So whether he did or didn't know about the provenance of those stocks is kind of immaterial. He played his role in that scheme, but there were much bigger fish. He was really a minnow in a sense in that entire operation. There were much bigger sharks behind him.
And I guess that's why I asked the question, is out of interest, was he a pawn or was he higher up on the in the scale of things? And that's what you get across the drug industry, is there's so many pawns that are just dispensable along the way. And literally, I guess, down to, as you say, like, real estate agents that are effectively selling property with laundered money, but the regulators don't mind, and so no questions are asked.
Well, it's not that the regulators don't mind in terms of real estate. It's that the federal government has not given the regulators the powers that they need. So they've basically built half of an anti-money laundering regime in Australia, and we've got this ferocious, really effective financial intelligence unit and regulator in AUSTRAC that's kind of, it's among the very best in the world at what it does. And the entire, we publish internationally at Thomson Reuters, and, the entire world is fascinated by these big cases in Australia and what AUSTRAC's been doing and some of the innovative things it's done building these public-private partnerships to tackle this issue. So you've got this amazingly effective agency with many great staff, but then the federal government says, we're not going to give you the power to go after lawyers. We're not going to give you the power to go after accountants. We're not going to give you power to go after real estate agents. And what that does is it means that they're fighting that fight with one arm tied behind their back. And anyone in those gatekeeper sectors, if you're running a massive money laundering scheme through property, you're going to need a lawyer to structure it, and you're going to need an accountant to set up your companies and do your finances, and you're going to need a real estate agent for the transactions. And yet anyone in that chain can claim plausible deniability because they're not required to form any suspicion whatsoever. They don't have to do any training. They don't have to have controls in place. to pick it up. So there's a whole lot of willful blindness would be a generous way to put it.
So from one Jordan to another, you've been traveling the world and I guess ending up training people in that part of the world about money laundering.
Yeah. And you know, there's so much goodwill around the world with regard to this international project to tackle illicit finance, because everyone, you know, A, it's coordinated through the Financial Action Task Force, which sits in Paris under the OECD, and it kind of coordinates this push internationally. And the reason that most countries are supportive of that is because, or at least the major economies are supportive of it, is because if you progress forward and tighten your economy and harden your economy, you will be losing market share to lesser regulated countries. So it's really one of those things where the world has to move forward incrementally in lockstep. Otherwise, the jurisdictions that forge the way, and so, for instance, the UK is one of those, they've gone really, you know, that they were a very early mover in terms of this financial intelligence sector. You know, it's in their interest to make sure that the rest of the world moves with them. So you've kind of got all of these developing countries like Jordan and, you know, Pakistan and other parts of the world where you'd be amazed how committed people are to this fight against financial crime. To put it in context, in Jordan, when someone works in a bank and reports that they've seen something suspicious and reports it to the financial intelligence unit, they're required to go and give evidence in court. And so I spoke with people who had been trailed home from work, you know, they're followed home, you know, these sorts of things, and they're made to feel an absolute chill about doing what they've done. And that sends this message out to the banking community to shut up and don't report, particularly around things like terrorism financing. Same in Pakistan. You know, I met people in Pakistan who have armed guards at their personal house 24/7, paid for by the bank, because they've reported on a terrorist organization. Somehow that information has leaked. So you're talking about people in those parts of the world that are, in my view, Jones, they're absolute heroes, because they're taking that personal risk to stand up for the values of integrity and fairness and all these other things that are fundamental to a decent financial system. And, you know, like I wanted to include some of those people in the book, because just like we've got heroes in Australia like Paul Jevtovic and others that are fighting the good fight, there's incredible people in parts of the world that don't often get much credit for the work that they're also doing.
Literally putting their lives on the line.
Literally.
So what about on the home front for us, mum and dad, investors, bank clients and so on? I mean, I think we've all been touched by data leaks recently, whether it be Medibank Private or Optus. We hear these terms, cuckoo smurfing. In fact, we've talked to our clients about cuckoo smurfing and so on. What can we do? I mean, I feel like for some people it's all a bit too hard. So it's a case of a bit of putting your head in the sand. Is there anything that we can do as individuals?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, we have a system in Australia where under the banking code, if people suffer a fraud against their bank account, the bank kind of bails them out. And certainly when it comes to credit card transactions, unless they're actually liable in some pretty egregious way, generally those transactions and fraudulent transactions get reversed. And the banks are really adept at picking that up. So that's one of the funny things in anti-money laundering, is that we sit back and we look at it and we go, hang on a minute. If it's a fraud where the bank loses money, you guys are sending people an SMS in real time that their account's just been compromised. But when it's money laundering, you know, which is lucrative for the bank, you guys don't see anything, or you're too slow to move, or it might take weeks. So that's a kind of a curious reality, is that they're very good at fraud detection. But, you know, at the same time, the scale of fraud is just going through the roof. So if you look at the data on scams, prior to COVID, I think it was about $850 million a year was being reported, and that's reported as, you know, losses that people had made through cybercrime. That during COVID went up to $2 billion. So that's $2 billion of reported losses in Australia from scams and romance scams and, you know, all these types of things. So there's a massive amount of losses going on. The banks aren't always covering them. And the banks are getting, you know, the banks can't just continue wearing losses as well. So they're increasingly kicking back and asking more questions of consumers and businesses that lose money through these spear phishing hacks and things like that. So I think we just have to be mindful that, you know, protecting yourself against financial crime isn't a job that the bank does. It's a job that every single Australian has to do. And, you know, just like we secure our doors and our houses and put screens up, you know, people have to take some responsibility in, you know, it's sad, but the reality is with cybercrime, we've got 25 million very wealthy Australians who are a honeypot to, you know, potentially 7 billion predators that are out there around the world. And law enforcement's reach only goes to our borders. And yet the threat in 80% of cases is coming from outside our borders. So we're in this environment where everyone really needs to educate themselves about the risks. And, you know, that I think that's a really important thing to convey, that we're starting to get more aware of this, about protecting ourselves online, about being more careful with who we send out identity documents to. I mean, it's amazing how often some business will ask you for a scan of your passport or something like that and get you to email it, you know, in plain text over the internet. These sorts of things have to stop. And, you know, simple things like turning on your pay ID in your internet banking is a really good step, or, you know, wherever you can, turning on two-factor authentication. These are initial steps. But we're certainly living in an era where you've got to start protecting yourself and being a lot more aware of the nature of this threat landscape.
Yeah, we're certainly talking to clients about this sort of stuff every week and having a password vault. And you know, it's not too hard to do these small steps to put the locks on the door and improve security.
And James, that is a beautiful analogy, because if someone down the road has their door wide open and you've got a lock on yours, you know, in most cases, they're going to go there. It's like the old joke in the Serengeti, where two campers wake up in the middle of the night and they can hear a lion, and one of them's putting his shoes on and the other one says, "Mate, why are you bothering? You're not going to be able to outrun a lion." He goes, "I don't need to, mate. I just need to outrun you." You know, that is the reality. Whereas don't make yourself an easy target. You don't need to be running military grade cybersecurity exactly. To make yourself the person that doesn't get hit.
Exactly. Just one quick question. How do you end up getting a jail sentence of 660 years?
Well, you can get that if you're Stephen Sokosha and you're one of the world's great money launderers. How he will serve that is another matter. I mean, that was an incredible case, wasn't it? He was one of the world's great financial criminals and is currently serving, 6 to 10 lifetimes in jail. So he won't be seeing, he'll be eating porridge right up to the end. But it is interesting, you know, one of the things that bugs me and anyone that works in the financial crime, anti-money laundering space is that, you know, we treat it, if someone, generally speaking, people haven't been doing long stretches for financial crime. The fraudsters might from time to time. You get your Madoffs and things like that that will do stretches in jail. But one of the big issues that we've got is that the people, the responsible parties within organisations, have too often walked away with their bonuses and left a smoking ruin behind for shareholders to fix up, you know, and that's something that really needs to change. And Mark ASIC's words, that is changing, because ASIC has been incredibly slow to move, but they've now, in the case of Star, initiated their first direct action against company directors and board and senior management for failures to basically act with skill, care and diligence in terms of managing non-financial risk. This is in relation to the stuff that we saw with the casinos and money laundering. So, you know, I mean, look, that's a small step, but as one of my great characters in the book, Martin Woods, who blew the whistle on cartel money laundering through Wachovia Bank when he was working as their money laundering reporting officer, he stood up and got absolutely annihilated for it. And I had a beer with him in London where he was saying to me that, you know, it's really important that we start holding executives to account, because effectively they're, you know, when they're laundering money, whether they know it or not, they've got a duty to that organisation and a broader duty to society to prevent this from happening. And if they're operating with skill and care and diligence, well, you know, this stuff isn't going to happen. But when they're willfully blind or negligent, his view is that they should be eating porridge, just like the people that move the drugs. I mean, why should moving the money be any different?
Exactly. Apparently, when James Packer heard about Star, he said, see, Crown wasn't anywhere near that bad.
Well, that's one way of rebuilding your character, isn't it?
So it could have been a lot worse.
Yeah.
Nathan, thanks so much for your time. It's such an amazing story, such an amazing book, full of interesting characters. And I really encourage everyone to get a copy and have a read. And we could talk for hours about what's in there, but people are going to have to just go and buy a copy. Tell us about what you do in your spare time when you're not researching financial crime and criminals and so on.
Well, you know, one thing about doing a job that you love is that you don't have much spare time. I write about crime and I go and educate and teach and all of that, which is kind of one of the things I love the most. So I don't really work. I just do what I love. But in my spare time, I've always been a bit of a lifelong tragic surfer. But surfing's really hard to do these days. There's so many people and so few waves. So I've now discovered flight boarding, where I go out into the middle of the ocean and zoom along for 90 minutes at a time, a couple of kilometres out to sea by myself, just like soaking up the wind and the waves. So that's my new hobby, and I'd encourage anyone that loves the ocean to give it a crack. It's just totally mind-blowing, and it's a really good way of clearing your mind too, because when you're out there, you can't think of anything else other than, you know, staying on that board and the beauty of the ocean. So it's a really cool, it's a cool experience, and it's a nice counterpoint to anyone who might have a desk-based job.
Awesome. So anyone that's complaining about the crowds when surfing, Nathan has a hack for you to escape the crowd.
And a great Australian company too, Flightboard. The boards are made here, so it's very cool. We still can innovate.
Support local if we can.
Yeah, definitely. And there is, there's this wave of innovation coming for investors around lithium-based batteries and how they're transforming transport. So, you know, I met a lady recently who started a small electric Vespa-style scooter business. You know, a lady from Perth moved to Sydney, set this thing up, Fons Moto. You've got Flightboard in Byron Bay building the world's best electric hydrofoil surfboards. So there's all this cool stuff happening out there. It's a good time for investors as well to follow some of this because, hey, it's, provided you're sourcing your energy from sustainable sources, which you can do with Flightboards and electric scooters, you can run them off your solar panels. That genuinely is green, sustainable transport.
Exactly. Oh, it was a good little wrap up. We managed to tie in being carbon neutral into the discussion, which is largely about governance. So,
it's all related, mate. ESG. ESG. you can't have one without the other.
Exactly. Thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it and look forward to having another chat in the future.
Oh, so great to chat. Thank you, James. And I look forward to taking you out on the flight board very soon.
I would love it. Thank you.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Green Dream Podcast. For information on the ways that we can help you on your ethical investment journey, visit www.justinvest.net.au. Please keep in mind that the information contained in this podcast is of a general nature and does not take into account your personal circumstances. Past performance is not a reliable indicator of future results. You should consider obtaining personalised professional advice from a licensed financial planner before implementing any significant financial decisions. In the spirit of reconciliation, the Green Dream acknowledges the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people.